Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start with Taylor Chalstrom today.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Rich Krebs, CCA and SSP, and contributing writer about keeping trees thirsty by manipulating soil salt content. Welcome back, Rich.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Rich, my first question for you here, why is keeping trees thirsty by manipulating soil salt content an important practice as harvest winds down here?
Well, I think that's, putting it in a perspective that way of keeping trees thirsty, where I was kind of going with some of the thought process on that in one of the latest articles was the fact that I created an analogy of sitting at a bar and a guy puts pretzels in front of you. The more pretzels you eat, the more beer you drink. So the bar does a whole lot better. Well, if you put that analogy into trees, you can kind of do the same thing by keeping things going up. All fertilizers are salts. And if you get the salts right, where the tree wants to draw on those salts back up into the leaves and get them actually into the tree, you're going to take water in a lot better. You're going to utilize water a lot better. The problem is when we talk about salt, what people are really talking about is sodium. So all fertilizer is pretty much salt. Sodium is the big issue. And if sodium takes the spot in a tree where potassium would go, or later magnesium, calcium, that kind of thing, you've basically blocked that receptor so the good stuff can't get in and it's been replaced with the bad. So you can keep your trees thirsty by adding salt to your water, but trying to do it with one, good salt, and two, in the right amounts. When we overdo it at any specific fertigation event, if it's too salty, you're not going to take in a whole lot of water. And if the ground is extremely salty, it's going to pull harder on your water than your roots can pull through osmosis. So it's a yin and yang. There's a lot of give and take in trying to get the salts right. But when you do utilize the salts right, it in essence makes your trees thirsty and you actually pull more water.
You're using that term good salts and bad salts. I'm curious what constitutes a good salt versus a bad salt.
So definitely your good old fashioned table salt, sodium chloride. Nobody puts in a fertilizer where they're sucking in sodium chloride, but chloride's coming out of well water as it's gotten worse over the years. There'll be a lot of chlorides that are in the water now. And there's a lot of sodium as well that's in the water, in addition to all the sodium that's still in soils that are sodic and in particular alkaline as well. So as far as the good salts are concerned, calcium and nitrate love to go in together. So if you've got a good balanced calcium nitrate, a calcium ammonical nitrate, a urea ammonical nitrate, those things with proper cations like magnesium and calcium and potassium can be very beneficial in creating a so-called good salt and combining to go into a plant together.
Rich, in that recent article you were referencing in West Coast Nut, you say that, quote, over applications like you are talking about a little bit can create more havoc than the benefits that we were trying to achieve. Can you kind of explain that ideology further?
Yeah, and I think most of that is easily relatable to nitrogen. So at the latest crop consultant conference, Keith Backman was talking about the over application of nitrogen, which happens a lot. And so oftentimes a farmer hears, you're putting on too much nitrogen, and immediately thinking he's just being berated for the amounts that he's putting on. But it's those big 50 and 60 unit slugs that go in a particular slug at a particular time. If you think about nitrogen, and a lot of Keith's research over, a lot of years of brilliant work has said that, typically a tree is going to take up 10 units a week. So if you're putting on 50, 60 units, if a tree can't take that up in 6 weeks and the water hasn't been managed properly, you're pushing that nitrate right below the root zone and it's going back out. So same thing happens with salts. We do these massive slugs. If we've over applied anything, if a plant can't take it up, and in particular, you've put on too much magnesium or calcium and you've got excess phosphorus that's in the ground that is not broken down, or it's in a polyform that just is not breaking down, your cations are going to reattach to that and create the rock we tried to mine in the first place to get those nutrients into a plant. So over application can be just as detrimental as under application.
Okay. So you're saying some of the other nutrients in the soil can affect kind of how the salt performs and reacts in the soil.
100%. I think we overlook that often. You look at the milliequivalents of what's coming out in the water, which actually tells you what your plants are drinking. What's actually solubilized in the water is different lots of times than the total load on a soil test of what the acetate rinsed. So when you compare those two numbers together, you may be only getting 2, 4, 5% of the calcium you think you're going to get with a balanced soil, and the amount of calcium you've got in that soil that's not actually what is being solubilized in the water. So the total load of all those nutrients, calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, you need to weigh those against what the plants are actually drinking in the soil solution, and then balance those just as much as getting the soils balanced and your ratios proper.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R almond, grizzly walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and platinum clonal pistachio rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Network with the top tier of the industry at this year's California TreeNut Conference. Featuring presentations from the top executives from CDFA and California's TreeNut Commodity Boards. Register at WCNGG.com and we'll see you in Tulare on November 3rd at the California TreeNut Conference. Does your crop have iron chlorosis? AgroPlantae has a solution for you. Traditionally, chelated iron has limitations that AgroPlantae's Iron Force does not. Iron Force, with its EDDHA chelation technology, can turn your plant's iron chlorosis from yellow to green in as little as 15 days, despite unbalanced soil pH and calcareous soils. From organic certified to conventional micronutrients, AgroPlantae has the product for you. Call 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplantae.com.
Hi, we're back talking with Rich Krebs, CCA, SSP, and contributing writer about keeping trees thirsty by manipulating soil salt content. Rich, does manipulating soil salt content differ amongst the types of tree nuts that are out there, or is it more dependent on, you know, existing soil conditions or maybe even fertilizer choices?
The actual manipulation of the soil salt is still done as a basic practice in general on just trying to make the ideal soil. So those calculations are, it's just math and science. And hey, if I do this, this is going to happen. If you think about the actual weight of soil, every 6 inches is 2 million pounds in an acre. So to go down to 2 feet, you know, 8 million pounds, that's a whole lot of soil that we've got to manipulate. So fall applications, dry mixes, different amendments that we're putting on, you have to put on massive amounts to actually make a difference in the percentages to what you're doing in the soil to manipulate that particular salt. So that being said, that's all done the same way. But an almond tree, you start getting to that 4 and 5 EC range and you're just way too salty, where a pistachio tree is still doing fine there and may not have an issue till it gets to 8 or 9 EC or a 10 on the sodium absorption ratio. So yes, the crop is definitely makes a difference. Almonds can't handle the salt like pistachios can. Pistachios are going to be better than walnuts. Walnuts are going to be better than almonds. So you definitely need to know not only what you're growing, but also what rootstock you put it on to make sure that will handle the soil that it's in.
You say, you know, pistachios can handle salt and salt manipulation a little better. Does that also follow along the same line that they can handle some of these bad salts maybe better than the other trees?
It's a great question. Quite frankly, I would tell you that, yeah, that's probably going to be the same thing, but it goes back to, again, what salt are we talking about? Typically, it's sodium that's going to be an issue. So when your soils are already alkaline and they're sodic, your sodium's high and your pH is up, you're going to be able to handle that soil better with a pistachio crop than an almond crop. But you really don't want it to, you know, put any of your trees in sodic saline solutions without trying to do some sort of manipulation to the water you're putting on those trees. And that goes to another point that it's easier to manipulate the root zone than worrying about the entire 2 million pounds in every 6 inches of soil. What can we do on the berms and in the wetting pattern where all the roots are growing?
Rich, another thing you mentioned in your article, you talked about rainfall a lot, how it's important for kind of flushing or rinsing out the soils with that higher quality water that is, of course, coming from the rain. How can growers really achieve that effect, that rinsing effect during times of drought?
Another great question. Times of drought has changed everything. So especially when it's been manipulated by the government. So I don't want to get political on you, but when we are now in year two of this drought, we're where we were in the last drought in year four, that is man-made. So we've got some issues. Was it awful this year for rainfall? Yes. So when I'm telling growers, hey, this is what we have to do to exacerbate your leaching fraction. You know, put this out at this time, right before it rains, we're going to get a half an inch and we're going to be able to push this much excess sodium through your root zone. That only works if a guy's got a well that's actually a decent amount of water to put on. If he's not able to get any kind of surface water delivery, which hasn't happened for a lot of growers this year. So a lot of the advice that we like to give, and it's an easy blanket statement for a crop advisor or sustainability specialist to say, hey, just do this. And a grower kind of laughs at you and say, how would you like me to do that? Because I have no way of making that happen. So if you do have the well water and it is bad at the end of the season, like it often is, especially when now the well that what you're drawing off of is at a higher bad concentration than it would be in a year that is not already well into a drought, there's going to be issues. You've got to acidify that water. You've got to break up the calcium carbonate that's in that water to try to then have the calcium take the place of the sodium. And you've got to add even more water now to try to increase the leaching fraction. So it sounds counterintuitive to put on more bad water to make a difference, but it really does if you have broken up the good cations to take the place of sodium. But you got to have water to do it. So with rainfall, that's the best way to make that happen.
Definitely. I'm curious kind of what that bad water, could it get to such a point for a grower if their water is just so bad that, you know, it is more detrimental for them to put it on the tree rather than just not water the trees at all?
Well, we had some growers that were dealing with water issues early in the year and when almond prices were still cheap that just said this year, all we're going to do is keep our trees alive. And they literally went out and knocked all the nuts off and pruned them back hard so that the tree, all its job was now was just to survive and look forward to 2022. That's terrible. I hope no other growers have to do that at all. And we have a great, wonderful wet winter. If we don't, and the government continues to do what it's doing now, we're going to run into those issues where a guy says, look, it's not worth me putting on this bad water. So, we're going to have to make changes quickly. And you know, when someone like me is saying this change needs to happen, I am not just, a fat cat sitting in a beautiful irrigation district where I've got wonderful water. If they do open up the valves again and I can make a difference. My driveway is literally the boundary of a white area. So I am completely 100% reliant on well water. I plant cover crops. I put mulch down, everything I can do to try to hold more water in the root zone so I can get away with growing a crop with less water being put on, especially if it's going to be bad water. So everyone that's listening right now, put your hands together and pray for rain. Hope God and Mother Nature come through for us and make something happen. Otherwise, with the condition our reservoirs are in right now, we will be in a whirl of hurt if we run through another year like this year.
Definitely valid points there, Rich. I'm curious about one other thing you mentioned in the article. You talk about fertilizer's salinity index and kind of the importance of that when deciding on what to apply to soil. Can you kind of go into that a little bit?
Yeah, certain salts are going to pull a lot harder than other salts. So there are companies out there that manipulate water that we put on an irrigation. And sometimes you hear the term, we make water wetter, you know, something along those terms. Well, they're not exactly wrong. It sounds funny, but changing how, you know, polarity or how water actually moves through soil can make a difference. Well, if a fertilizer has a very high salinity index, like sodium nitrate or even ammonia nitrate, something with a high salinity index, higher salts are going to pull harder on water than others. And as your soils get bad and they have a larger salt content, and especially of a salt that has a higher salinity index, the soil actually pulls harder on water than a root can pull on to try to get water into that root. So the higher salinity index and specific fertilizers can be detrimental, and you can get away with stuff with a lower index if need be in you know, critical years when you're trying to make something happen. So that's really important to go over with your CCA to see what form of nutrition you're putting on and how do you then create something with a lower salinity index to make sure it goes into the plant and just doesn't add to the total salt load of the ground and pull on your water.
Definitely. If you could kind of help me visualize the physical process that's happening when that polarity is too high for the roots to compensate. So is it basically pulling the water past the roots and down into the profile where they just simply cannot reach it anymore? Is that kind of what's going on there?
Gravity actually does more of that than what the salt's doing. But if you think about a root that is just a vertical root that's going straight down into the ground. So on either side of that root is going to be your soil that also has your cations, your anions, and when they're together, they're a specific salt. But when they do solubilize and break apart, everything's a charge. Calcium's got a double charge, magnesium's a double charge, sodium single, potassium single, sulfate's gonna be, you know, single, so, but either negative or positive. So water, when it breaks apart, whether it's we call it H2O, but you're going to have hydrogen ions, you're going to have your hydroxide ions, and combined together in balance at a perfect pH of 7, they all sit there in perfect harmony. When something's more acidic, you have more H. When something is more basic, you have more OH. And so those things are going to be attracted, and OH is going to be more attracted at a negative charge to a double positive charge calcium and pull harder that direction towards the calcium than a plant trying to grab that hydroxide and take it into itself. So if that made sense, it basically all comes down to thinking about your battery. It's just charges in which way that water is going to move now on what factions of soil and what factions are happening in your root, who's pulling harder. It's a massive tug of war and it's all based on charges.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that, Rich. My last question for you here, any other tips for growers that you might have to manipulate their soil salt content as we go into the fall here?
Yeah, if you are under what we talked about earlier, the parameters of just not having water, you can go out with some gear-driven rigs and even put out acidifying products into the crotch of the berms, specifically over the wetting patterns of the roots right before it rains, to try to let Mother Nature take some of that in, break up some more of the salt to try to allow then calcium, magnesium, potassium to attach to your soil and run sodium through. If you do have some water and you can get away with a short irrigation set, 4 or 5 hours, right when it starts raining, and then let Mother Nature with cleaner and more acidic water actually do the heavy lifting for you and the rinsing, that is certainly helpful. Any organic matter you can increase, 1% increase in organic matter in the ground will hold 20,000 more gallons per acre. So planting cover crops that are brought up by rainwater when we do get rain, you're not utilizing irrigation for the cover crop, let Mother Nature do it, but now you're increasing the organic matter. The chlorophyll content of that crop that now gets put back into the ground is gonna increase your magnesium. The nitrate from the air, nitrogen from the air is now gonna be fixed and put into the ground, which will enable us to use less fertilizer if we've stored it into the roots of legumes. So a lot of the things we've heard for years, but now make a whole lot more sense when we're running into a water crisis, will certainly help a grower get away with using less water, especially if it next year goes to $2,500 an acre foot or higher. Everything you can do to hold more in the root zone is going to be very beneficial.
Definitely. I appreciate your emphasis on the cover crops and kind of the sentiments there. Thank you, Rich, for coming on and talking about manipulating soil salt content as well. Really important practice. As always, appreciate you coming on.
Well, always a pleasure to speak with you. Love your passion and your gift of trying to help our growers understand this better and doing better practices. We'll find a way as farmers to get through this. So thank you for your passion.
Yep, that's all we can do. Appreciate it, Rich. This is Taylor with My Ag Life signing off.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. That is there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Here's your news brief for today. Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed legislation to help farmers and ranchers rescue livestock during wildfires. Assembly Bill 1103 creates a statewide program called AgPass. The new law will allow farmers, ranchers, and managerial employees to have access to livestock during wildfires or other natural disasters. The AgPass would permit them to pass law enforcement checkpoints and enter their properties without escort. Does the U.S. Forest Service have enough money and people to meet today's critical needs? One Forest Service official says no. Gary Crawford has more.
On Capitol Hill Thursday, a frank statement from the U.S. Forest Service's second in command.
We do not have enough resources or capacity to address the needs in front of us right now.
Forest Service Deputy Chief Christopher French telling a Senate subcommittee that on the fire suppression side,
we are losing a number of our skilled wildfire specialists to other agencies,
which seem to offer better pay and benefits. French was asked if the federal vaccination mandate would accelerate loss of firefighters.
Don't know yet. We're currently assessing those numbers.
Meanwhile, French said that for years now, money designated for forest planning and management has been siphoned off to fight the wildfires, and the result of that,
we've seen about a 40% decline in our natural resource professionals across the agency. We just can't pay for those positions anymore. That includes land management planning,
which he says partially explains why the Forest Service is behind schedule in updating many forest use plans across the country. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The National Corn Growers Association joined 51 other groups in sending comments to the U.S. Department of Transportation on the many issues currently disrupting the U.S. supply chain. The comments offered recommendations on how to alleviate those challenges through legislative and regulatory actions. Their recommendations on inland waterways included prioritizing legislative and regulatory actions that promote the rehabilitation of aging waterway infrastructure on the upper Mississippi and Illinois rivers. The groups also encouraged the Surface Transportation Board to allow reciprocal or competitive switching, which would allow shippers and receivers geographically beholden to one rail carrier to gain access to a second rail carrier through a short-distance switch. USDA's Farm Service Agency and multiple partners are joining together in a new initiative designed to measure soil carbon sequestration with specific Conservation Reserve Program practices. Rod Bain reports.
A new USDA initiative is designed to measure and monitor soil carbon sequestration on Conservation Reserve Program acres.
What this program will do, working with partners, we'll start to be able to quantify that in terms that are directly related to our CRP program and our CREP programs.
Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau says partners from land grant, nonprofit, and private business entities will conduct soil carbon sampling efforts and carbon mitigation initiatives in three CRP practice types.
Perennial grasses, trees, and wetlands are the three focus areas. And out of all the applicants, we selected one project that could be really representative of a broad base of program participation in each of those areas.
The administrator breaks down each specific initiative project, starting with one focused on perennial grasses.
With perennial grasses, we're going to be working with Michigan State University on over 600 sites across the U.S. with a focus in those central states, and that'll encompass native grass plantings, rangeland, and pollinator habitat practices.
A second initiative concentrates on conservation practices involving trees.
We're going to work with Mississippi State University as well as a partnership with Alabama A&M to collect above and below ground data at 162 sites across seven southeast states to try to document those CRP-related benefits to soil and carbon sequestration.
As for the third soil carbon monitoring initiative and its focus area,
the wetlands, the natural partner there is Ducks Unlimited and the partners that they have in their network, and they're going to collect data on carbon stocks in wetland soils as well as vegetation carbon levels on 250 wetland sites across a 15-state region in the central United States.
Administrator Ducheneau notes the importance of producer and landowner involvement in generating both data from and benefits within these initiatives. initiatives.
So as we move closer towards a reality where there is a market for that sequestration of carbon, we want producers that have been enrolled in our conservation programs to be able to point to the work that they've done, identify the amount of carbon sequestration they've been able to facilitate so that they are able to participate as well when these carbon markets come to bear.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg says U.S. ethanol production reached its highest level since COVID-19 lockdowns brought the industry to a basic standstill. The ethanol industry reached production that hasn't seen since June of 2019. Gasoline demand on a four-week rolling average hit the highest point since 2007 for this time of the year. The revival comes as corn is readily available at a relatively cheap price, setting the stage for better profit margins and a potential boost in overseas demand for U.S. supplies. Meanwhile, a dairy farmer near London, Ontario, is the first Eastern Canadian farm to deliver processed methane gas directly into Ontario's natural gas grid. Dennis Guy reports.
Methane generated by biodigesters has typically been used to fuel on-farm power generators, but this project is the first time an on-farm biodigester is directly supplying Ontario's large natural gas consumer grid. Stanton Brothers Dairy Farms, first investment in biogas-fueled renewable energy production, was an on-farm digester powering 3 250-kilowatt electricity generators. This summer, a second biodigester was completed, but instead of fueling generators, this unit pressurizes, scrubs, purifies, and delivers renewable natural gas to one of Canada's largest natural gas utility companies. Murray Logan, site operations manager for Rural Green Energy, one of Stanton Brothers' partners in the operation, says the methane produced by the digester needs to be scrubbed before it can be fed into the grid.
The biomethane that's produced from the digester on the farm has to meet a pipeline quality standard. The biggest obstacle of cleaning up biomethane is moisture. So we have to heat and cool and condense that moisture and pull it from the gas. We also have to scrub it through activated charcoal to remove the sulfur. So the gas utility meters that. The methane quality is measured constantly.
There are already methane biodigesters feeding utility gas grids operated by municipal and private interests, but Stanton's dairy operation is the first on-farm digester in Ontario to supply directly to a utility grid. The renewable gas operation provides another stream for the Stanton dairy operation, but the hope is that Ontario will follow British Columbia's example for renewable natural gas. So Stanton's supply contract is with British Columbia-based Fortis, a utility company with experience in large-scale methane distribution.
The utility is always seeking more renewable natural gas, so they've gone outside the province to source it. A homeowner in British Columbia can voluntarily sign up to utilize renewable natural gas as a fuel in their home or business and as an offset get a tax credit for doing it. The only way a large-scale operation could justify an anaerobic digester was to have that contract in hand. This gives them yet another revenue stream.
Murray Logan is with Rural Green Energy based at Woodstock. Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
The Department of Agriculture is offering grants to help wood products and energy companies support sustainable forest management practices to reduce wildfire risk. The USDA Forest Service is accepting applications for funding from 2022 Wood Innovation and Community Wood Grant programs. Some $13 million in funding will support ventures that use forest materials in wood energy production or wood product manufacturing. A series of USDA Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program grants address various aspects of benefit and program integrity, efficiency, and delivery at the state and local levels. Here's Rod Bain once again.
And investment in integrity. The integrity and efficiency of USDA Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program at the state and local levels.
We've got about $53 million across different grant programs, so it's pretty comprehensive.
And as SNAP Associate Administrator Jessica Shaheen explains, these investments address both aspects of program integrity.
It is about the access to the program. You want to make sure you have the integrity that it is fully accessible to all customers who are eligible for it. And then also that it is done properly and correctly and within the federal rules and regulations.
With projects within the 8 grants available involving a wide range of coverage areas. For example, data and analysis.
The process technology and improvement grants, this is almost $5 million that was awarded to 7 state agencies and nonprofits to enhance the user experience applying for SNAP and receiving notifications about what's needed to complete that application. It also strengthens the ability to do the work in a situation like the pandemic.
Other examples of data and analysis-based SNAP administration and program integrity grants include efforts to use third-party databases to improve income verification to projects advancing recipient fraud prevention. The grants also support projects related to customer service, SNAP employment and training programs, and nutrition.
We're particularly excited about improving access to healthy fruits and vegetables for SNAP households, and we're doing that through the SNAP online purchasing participation assistance for farmers and farmers markets. So this grant, the nonprofit will actually be working to facilitate a platform for online payment for SNAP at farmers markets. There's also the healthy fluid milk incentive pilot, where an additional $930,000 was awarded to Baylor University Collaborative on Hunger and Poverty to support the development and testing of using incentives to encourage SNAP households to buy and drink more milk.
And grants also address technological improvements and efficiencies.
One of these grants is going for doing applications through an online portal. Another one actually uses a bot process.
That's bot, B-O-T.
So it's happening in an automated way. So it's much faster and more accurate. And then one of my favorites is a mobile community service office where they're actually going to be going out into rural areas where the access to the program is limited and conduct the eligibility and certification process right there in the community.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news for today. We'll be right back.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. Hemp is an old crop with a lot of old history, but it is writing some new history right now. Gary Crawford has more on this edition of Agriculture USA.
There was an old song that was a hit back in 1974 and 5, which I think applies very well to what we're going to talk about today.
Because everything old is new again.
And if ever that applied to anything, it's to a new old crop called hemp. Coming up, a look at old hempy history and some new hemp history, which is in the making right now. On this edition of Agriculture USA, I'm Gary Crawford. A wise speech and drama teacher once told me it's very effective to open up a presentation with a good joke. But we don't have any good jokes, so you'll have to take what we do have. And here it is, a hokey hemp joke.
Did you hear about the guy that crossed hemp with hops?
Hemp used to make rope?
Yeah.
He did what?
He crossed hemp with hops.
What'd he get, Reggie?
And the answer is... Well, let's stop it there. That same teacher told me to open up with a question and save the answer until the end, so the audience might stay awake. We'll see. But back to the theme.
Everything old is new again.
So if there's anything old in crops, it's got to be hemp, an ancient cousin of the marijuana plant. There's evidence of it being used in China some 10,000 years ago as a food source and for making fabrics and baskets, ropes and other things. But let's fast forward to the early 1600s.
It came to the U.S. colonies. They begin growing hemp almost immediately with the first settlements.
That's Agriculture Department economist and history expert Ann Eftland. She says hemp history has been connected with American history from the very start. For example, the year 1776.
The resolution on independence is adopted.
And hemp was there, according to some historians.
The Declaration of Independence, or at least some of the drafts of it, were done on hemp paper. The final is on parchment.
Also, same year, some experts say...
The flag that Betsy Ross made, the first U.S. flag, was made of hemp fabric.
And hemp was used to make all sorts of things that had strategic value, including sails and ropes for ships. Hemp was best suited for southern climates, but Ann Eflin says after the cotton gin was invented, 1794, cotton began to take over and replace hemp as the big crop.
But the real end to hemp growing in the U.S. came in 1937 when the Marijuana Tax Act was passed.
Hemp was lumped in with marijuana, and if you grew it, you had to pay a hefty tax, and farmers found it unprofitable to grow hemp, and they stopped growing it, except during World War II. But after the war, the tax on hemp was back, and farmers went back to other crops. And the final nail in the coffin, 1970.
America's public enemy number one is drug abuse.
President Nixon signs the Controlled Substances Act, making it not just unprofitable to grow hemp, but
illegal to grow hemp.
And it stayed that way until Congress passed the 2014 Farm Bill that authorized some pilot farm research projects on growing hemp to be carried out. And then in 2018, a new page in hemp history.
It's my great honor to sign the 2018 Farm Bill,
which legalized growing of hemp. Now, for most crops, the Agriculture Department does surveys. They put out regular reports on acreage, production, and prices so that producers and buyers have good information on which to operate and make decisions. Of course, USDA has not done any market survey work on hemp in well over 60 years, but right now, more hemp history is being made.
This is the beginning. This is the start.
Gerald Tillman with USDA's Statistics Service says his agency is right now making hemp history by doing its first comprehensive survey of the nation's hemp industry in well over 60 years. Surveys are being mailed out as we speak to all known hemp producers. We know that about 20,500 farmers have been issued licenses to grow hemp this year. The survey will be asking them about such things as planted acreage. And Bill Richmond with USDA's Marketing Service told us they're also asking what products the hemp will be used for.
We're also very interested in the prices received by producers. And so we ask in the survey what prices are being received at the farm gate level so we can better understand some of the economics around what hemp is being sold for in the countryside.
With the overall goal
to try to best capture the entire national landscape of hemp.
For the first time in many decades, the plan is to publish the results of this survey this coming February. All of this proving, once again,
when everything old is new again.
Oh, speaking of old, we started with an old joke, you know, but we saved the punchline for the end, so here goes.
Did you hear about the guy that crossed hemp with hops?
What'd he get, Reggie?
Jumping ropes.
Oh, it was not worth the wait, was it? Well, anyway, this has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.